funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does the search for a life partner have in common with buying car insurance, selling stuff on eBay, or deciding which gas station to patronize when it's time to fill up? The suggestion that our quest for love has anything in common with a business transaction may not sound very romantic, but as my guest today has discovered through personal experience, we can actually improve our success when seeking a mate by understanding the economic principles that underlie the dating market. Paul Oyer is Fred H. Merrill, Professor of Economics at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. His new book is called Everything I Need to Know About Economics I Learned from Online Dating. He joins us today from the studios at Stanford University. Paul, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much for having me.
So you're a professor of economics, and I have to imagine that maybe you apply economics to everything in your life. Had you thought much about its applicability to dating before you found yourself back in the market?
No, I had never really given it any thought, the relationship between those two things. The last time I was dating, I was not an economist. And this time when I went back into dating, I immediately saw the value of online dating because it seemed a very good way to meet people and so forth. And immediately then, once I started doing it again, I saw the parallels between online dating. I mean, I'm a labor economist, so the first thing that sort of hit me is how similar Match.com or sites like that are to Monster.com. Hmm. But then the parallels began to sort of build from there.
Well, the first concept you tackle here is the subject of settling, which plays really nicely into the economic concept of utility.
Yeah, I mean, to an economist, settling is just something we do all the time, every day. There are so we always settle for imperfection. There are so many things we want to do, and if we had unlimited time, we would do different things. But economics is the study of scarce resources, and in many cases, the scarce resources are time. So when searching for a partner, when searching for a job even, we have to balance the value of continuing our search against the fact that there are many other things we need to go and do.
Of course, the availability of online dating does open up the marketplace, right? We can find not just, you know, one person, you know, in a month who might be interested in dating, but thousands of them right there.
Yeah, and that's, of course, a great thing when we put it that way. Now, it has the downside. Sometimes too much choice can be overwhelming or even problematic, but it's definitely the case that for a guy like me who's a little older, not obviously running into a lot of eligible women in my age range, online dating certainly provided a marketplace, if you will, that I wasn't going to find in any sort of more traditional manner.
What does it take for online daters to maximize their utility in this process?
It's a good question. It's a good question. And it depends. I mean, you have to keep in mind what your utility function is, so to speak. So for me, I went into it looking for my next long-term relationship. And so in order to find that, that required thinking about where was I likely to find the best pool, if you will. And so one economic concept that's very important when starting out is where is the market thick, what economists would call thick. So when you think about stock markets and things like that, we like really thick markets because it brings a lot of competition and that leads to price competition, and it's good for people when buying or selling stocks. Well, in the market for partners, it's very different. Unlike commodities, the partners, when you think about the job market or the market for life partners, every possible match out there is different. No two are the same. And so we want thick markets, not because we want some sort of competition, but because we want to maximize the possibility that we're going to find the best match out there. So that's, you know, one thing I thought about, and I focused very much on the larger websites as a result of that.
I had a friend once who was on Match.com, and he said the beauty of it was that he knew that every woman on there was interested in dating. They might not turn out to be interested in dating him, but at least he knew he was in a place where everybody had the same intention.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you're you're sort of, that's the beauty of a market, right? So you go to the bazaar in Istanbul, if you will, or wherever, and you know everybody there is interested in buying and selling. Well, it's, you know, in everyday life, if you just walked around looking for partners, very few of the people you run into are going to also be looking for partners. Mm-hmm. So online dating provides a marketplace, which is, to put it in very sort of dry economics terms, it's pretty liquid. It's a thick market. It has exactly the advantage your friend mentioned.
I suppose one of the disadvantages as compared with regular buying and selling markets is that both sides really have to agree, not simply on the price of what you might spend on a date or what you might do together, but whether they want to spend time together.
Yeah. No, and that's where there are certain markets where the parallels end. So in the book, I sort of talk about eBay, buying or selling things on eBay, and how that has many, you know, we can take things some of the principles you run into in online dating and apply those in eBay. You can't apply that many because, you know, at the end of the day, somebody just wants some money and then the transaction is over. I think the parallels to the job market run much deeper. So, you know, when you go to find a job, it's a little bit like finding a life partner. The employer has to love you back, not love, obviously, but the employer has to want you back. And that's these two-sided matching markets, job markets, and life partner markets. Those have some differences over other more traditional markets, like if you just go into a mall and somebody buys and sells something.
So it can be a good thing that the costs are relatively low to, you know, let someone know we're interested if we are dating online. Then again, each contact might be perceived as not very valuable to the people we reach out to.
Right. So the downside of online dating is once you make the market very thick, then we're now overwhelmed by choice. So the problem I might have had in the absence of online dating was I would have just found very few eligible women my age in the greater Palo Alto area, but just by running into them and friends of friends. Well, the problem you have once you go to a thick market like Match.com is there are literally hundreds or thousands or whatever of people in the right age range within a certain area. And so that's a problem again that's nice to think about in this context because it applies so many other places as well, the job market being another great example. It's so easy to just put your resume on monster.com. Well, then the firms out there are overwhelmed by resumes. And so as these markets become thicker, as they become more efficient in some ways as they go online, technology has to keep up, not in a different way. And that is, if Match.com is just giving me literally hundreds or thousands or however many women to choose from, that's actually not that useful. But if Match.com or some other big website is able to make its algorithm better and better over time so that it can take the thousands of women on its website but focus me on 10 for whom I might be a very good match, then that online dating becomes very efficient. Now, the problem is, as we get into in many contexts in the book, that people have incentives to distort what they say in their profiles. And mm-hmm. So it's very hard for Match.com to come up with an algorithm that's that focused.
Well, you write about this concept in game theory called cheap talk. How does that relate to the way people present themselves online?
Right. So cheap talk is just economists' way of saying lying. Although, although I take that back because there are times where we don't. So there are times on an online profile, just as on your resume, where you have every incentive to be honest and very straightforward. And then there are other times where you have incentives to exaggerate. And those can be problematic, both in a job context and when online dating. The evidence that people do exaggerate in their online profiles is quite amazing and really interesting. There's been a couple of research papers. There's been less formal study of this by the people who run the OkCupid website. If you look on a website, you'll find just a disproportionate number of men who are exactly 6 feet tall.
and who make over $100,000.
And who make over $100,000. And, you know, so people have an incentive, obviously, to grab people's attention by saying those things. Also, you know, a lot of people are 49 years old or 39 years old who should, you know. So there's definitely some shading of the truth going on there. Now, you have to be careful from if you stop and think about, okay, you know, if you get overly economics ease on yourself and you say, okay, I have to think about maximizing my utility here. And you say, I'm going to try to attract other people by saying I'm younger than I am. But of course, you can't go too far. Mm-hmm. If you go too far, then it becomes a waste of time. And the person upon meeting you says, okay, you know, this is not the person that I thought I was meeting. And they immediately claim to have a phone call that they have to go respond to. There's a iPhone app called Fake a Call that I think is very useful for sort of getting around what's known for these exaggerations that go a little too far.
So in other words, oh, I have an emergency and I have to cut this date short.
Yes, yes. It's amazing how many emergencies happen in the first 5 minutes of the first online date, the first meeting after of a couple that have met online.
So if you have the sense, Paul, that everybody is gilding the lily a little, are you penalized in this dating market for not following suit?
Yeah, that's you know, when people, when I talk about, well, what's the advice, you know, that comes out of from an economist thinking about the dating market, this is where I begin to feel a little bit bad, because I would hate to say to somebody, you know, you should exaggerate. But on the other hand, you do have to keep in mind that everybody else is. And I don't mean everybody. There are people for whom lying is so costly in some other way that they would never do that. They would never stretch the truth, or they're going to be. But you do put yourself at, for lack of a better term, a competitive disadvantage if you entirely tell the truth. Of course, you know, if you're such a winning person and you have a great, you know, you're just amazing looking and you really are 39, then I guess you don't, maybe you can get away with telling the truth. But it is for, you know, it's an unfortunate truth that you have to keep in mind that everybody else, not everybody, but there's a lot of mischaracterization going out there, on out there. And again, it's not just an online dating thing. I mean, think about on your resume, you exaggerate a little bit here and there, or you at least make things, you leave off certain things that might provide useful information that isn't as positive about you and so forth. And you do that, you know, why do you do that? Well, you want to present yourself in a positive light, but also the other people looking for that job, you know, they're doing it too. And so you have to think about these things.
So occasionally, Paul, in the consumer market, we look to independent reviewers to tell us whether or not the information presented about a product is accurate. And it turns out that people have at least attempted to create a parallel system in the dating world.
To my knowledge, the only thing that's done here is the site Lulu, and it's women rating men. So you have to sign in through Facebook, and it determines your gender and so forth. That's the only site I've seen, at least in the U.S. So apparently what happens on this site, and I recently went in and tried to figure out if anybody had said anything about me, but apparently on this site, I believe the exact URL, for those of you out there who are curious, is onlulu, onlulu.com. It's called Lulu.com, and women post profile or post reviews of men they've dated. To my knowledge, that's a relatively new thing, whereas historically, online dating suffered from the fact that, you know, if you want to draw the parallel to eBay and some other places, they didn't have this ability to follow up on people and to say, hey, this guy always exaggerates the things he puts up for sale and so forth. So I haven't actually been able to see any of the reviews on Lulu because I'm male, but I've always been curious, not so much about, you know, about what people say.
My guest is Paul Oyer. He is Fred H. Merrill Professor of Economics at the Stanford Graduate School of Business and author of the new book, Everything I Need to Know About Economics I Learned from Online Dating. We'll resume the conversation in a minute. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you: the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Fred H. Merrill, professor of economics at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, Paul Oyer. The title of his book, and I want to clarify this here, is Everything I Ever Needed to Know About Economics I Learned from Online Dating. My apologies for mangling the title a bit earlier, but we've got it right from here on out. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you've got a question about economics or about dating, and I'm not sure we've ever offered both of those in the same show before, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Paul, if I want to buy a house, I might put in an offer, but I don't really know how many other people are interested in this house and how much they've offered. How does that resemble online dating and signaling one's interest to a potential partner?
Yeah, that's the house market is very similar to online dating in some ways. So, for example, the no two are exactly alike idea, that follows, right? So the idea that you want to think very carefully about which house you're going to pick in the same way that you want to think very carefully about which partner you're going to pick. And by the same token, that you want to keep looking, but at a certain point you want to say, okay, this house is good enough. Sure, I don't like the crown molding or the lack of crown molding.
I can change that later.
It's exactly right. And that's a place where the parallels end. Mm-hmm. I think now we're getting outside my realm of expertise, but I would guess many a relationship where the person said, oh, I can change that later, did not work out as well as making the same decision when it comes to buying a house. So those are the places where it's similar. Now, another place where it's similar is in certain markets, like when the market's really hot and the person's getting multiple offers, then sure, it's a little bit like online dating in that you want the other side to like you back. But for the most part, the other side just wants your money, and then the transaction is over. So the differentiated good aspects, the fact that you want to search until you find one that is good enough rather than until you find the perfect partner and or perfect house, that part follows quite closely. But for the most part, the relationship with the other side the house usually doesn't have to like you back. Now, there are exceptions to that. I know you get into these markets where there are 10 buyers and each one writes a letter to the other side about how, you know, oh, I can see my children growing up and you've done such a nice job on your house and so forth. But those are more the exception than the rule. So I think the fact that a house doesn't have to like you back sort of changes things a little bit.
So I do want to take the parallel a little farther, because when you make an offer on a house, you want to try to make the most attractive offer possible.
That's true.
And typically we do that by, you know, scraping up as much cash as we can come up with. And as it turns out, at least for men, at least on a first date, it doesn't hurt to really pull out that Amex and keep it open.
Well, so you have to think about what you're trying to do. Right. So in the book, I talk about this idea of signaling. And if I want to credibly, I can say to you, hey, I'm rich, but you don't know whether I'm telling you the truth or not. Like I said, on average, people exaggerate their income on websites. So how could I show you that I'm rich in a credible manner? Now, putting aside, if we were just literally only focusing on the economics, and remember, the title of the book is You Can Learn a Lot About Economics from Online Dating, I would not tell you that you should only apply that you, when you do online dating, you should ignore everything besides economics, because even I will admit that will get you into some trouble. And so, but focusing for a second on just the economic side of this, how could I show you on the first date that I was really rich? Well, on the first date, you could bring out, like you said, you could bring out the Amex, you could show up in your BMW, and you could suggest going to somewhere very expensive and just lay it all out there, spend a ton of money on the person. And that would be what an economist would call a successful way of signaling. And what a signal does is it credibly separates you from those who say they have some trait but don't have it. And the way you have to be credible is you have to waste a little bit of money. So in this case, you waste money, if you will, on the first, not waste. I mean, that may not be exactly the right term, but you're using up a lot of money on the first date. And you're doing that because men who claim to be rich but aren't cannot do that. And so in a house, In a house, how would you signal if you were going to buy a house? Well, first of all, you put in the if signaling is works differently there, because if you say, I really have the money to buy, if all the seller cares about is your money, you signal by giving them, you know, it's easy to credibly signal you have a mortgage and so forth, and you put down an offer and you either can back it up or you can't. Now, of course, if the other, if the person selling the house cares about more than just money, then you have to think about, well, how, again, these letters I mentioned where people say, oh, I can see my kids growing up here and so forth. Those are very, any time-consuming thing that shows that, hey, I really mean what I say, that's a credible, that's what we like to think of as a credible signal. So you can waste money, if you will, on a first date by showing somebody how rich you are by spending a lot of money. Or you can waste time, if you, and waste is maybe the wrong word there as
spend.
Well. But if spend, you can spend time in a way that somebody who doesn't really mean it when they say, I'm very interested in you, won't bother. So I think for somebody who's, and so the spending money on the first date, that's one way to show you really are rich. But a lot of people would think that also shows other things, like you're, I don't know, a show off and you're, you have no class and things like that. So other ways of signaling can be spending time rather than money. So for example, I think a very important thing is before you meet somebody, you know, the first message you send somebody, if you want to say, hey, I looked at your profile, you look great, let's meet. Well, that's, you know, that's cheap talk.
Mm-hmm.
But the way you turn it into a credible signal is you spend 20 minutes on the message saying, I was looking at your your online profile. I also like dogs. I also agree with you about this particular movie. I actually don't like the TV show that you like, but, you know, and if you show in that first message that you've thought carefully about why you should meet, I think that sends a much stronger signal.
More attractive than you're hot. Let's get together.
It's yes, it's more, it comes off at it. It's more meaningful.
Although exactly. Let's be honest here, Paul, because I think a lot more men than women might respond to an email that says, you're hot, let's get together.
I'm laughing because I didn't get those emails, so I can't tell you for sure. I can't tell you for sure how men would react to that. But I would not be surprised if a lot of men found that very attractive, whether or not it was credible. That's true.
Well, one of the things that you discovered in researching all this is that, for example, if men have a big job and a high income, and this is, you know, sort of a verifiable thing, that turns out to be statistically appealing to most women, and we realize we're generalizing here. On the other hand, women who have those assets, it doesn't even make a difference if they are not perceived to be physically attractive. Is that right?
Right. So, And again, like you said, we're averaging. But for a typical man, looks matter a lot in terms of who they are attracted to, both in online dating and any other measure you might get. Whereas for men, women are attracted to men who make more money. That's the thing that on average is the most important driver of who women respond to emails from and so forth. They definitely respond more to men who are better looking as well. Now, so that doesn't mean men shouldn't care at all about their looks. I don't mean to suggest that. For one thing, as I talk about in a different context in the book, you get paid more if you look better.
Hmm.
So even aside from, if you want to do well in online dating as a man, looking better will help you make more money, which will then in turn help you do well online dating. So investments in how you look for either gender actually have either direct or indirect benefits for your online dating attractiveness.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hey, Chris. Hey, Paul. How are you guys doing?
Very well, thank
Good.
You.
Good. How are you?
Good. I'm doing fine, thank you. A couple of points I wanted to make. I'm a psychologist who knows a little bit about statistics, and you're approaching this from an economic perspective. And I was thinking about, I find your economic perspective valuable, but I think we ought to think about this from a statistical perspective as well. Okay?
Sure.
Let me just make 2 points. I could make many, but I'll just make two. number one is, three actually. Number one is that in online dating, what you get is what you put in. And let me just talk about that for a second.
Well, and let me just, if you're going to make a lengthy point, just pick your favorite one.
Okay, let me cut to the chase really fast. Number one is you have to be careful who you select to send a message to. Number two is you've got to keep the message the right length, not too long, too little, because you don't want to invest too much time. You want to save your time as much as possible. And finally, the whole thing is a pyramid, the top of which is something you determine what your goal is, and the bottom of which is all the contacts you have. Because contacts will result in a small number of dates, will result in a small number of third dates, will result in a small number of relationships, which ultimately will get you someplace. But it's all statistics.
Those are great and interesting points, John. You put a lot on the table there, so let's give Paul a chance to respond.
Yeah, I mean, I think my response is, yep, I totally agree. And I would use different language, but I totally agree about that. The pyramid idea and the fact that statistically the pyramid idea is, I'll just talk about for 1 second. You know, if you go on a site like Match.com, there are thousands of women. And in my case, I was looking at women. If, you know, depending on your gender and sexual preference, you might be looking at whatever. But the number that I was actually interested in or would be interested in me was a very small number. And you have to figure out how to quickly get there. You want Match.com to help you do it. And then you have to very efficiently use your time. And I think you pointed out, John pointed out, you know, you want to keep the message. I gave you, through the signaling idea, a reason why your message length should be very long. But there's this countervailing effect of, well, you know, but on average, you're probably not going to work out with that person. So you're wasting time if you make it too long. So you have to, I agree with him completely. You have to balance the length of your message. You have to think very carefully about how am I going to get from the so many people out there to the few that are really worth thinking about. So I completely agree, with the statistical way of thinking about this as well.
So given that the number of potential partners ultimately sort of boils down to a much smaller number than the overall number of individuals on a site, why go with a larger site rather than one of the more niche things, you know, like divorced dog-loving Northern California economist Match.com?
So that's a really good question. And I thought about that a lot, and I went on the dog lover site originally. And there are a certain set of people who, for whom the niche site makes sense. And those are people where the thing they're selecting on is so important to them that they should focus on that type of site. And there are enough of those people out there that for whom they can focus on those types of sites. So, for example, ChristianMingle.com is a very successful large website, even though it's specialized. It's specialized on Christian people. I believe there are LDS sites that are also very successful and very focused on that certain group. But the key thing there is those people, it was an absolute must that they have that one criteria, that one characteristic. Dog lovers, that's not enough. There aren't, I mean, I was hoping to meet a dog lover, and I did. My girlfriend has dogs, and I have to keep her from trying to get more of them rather than worry about whether or not she's going to like my dog. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't a if I limited myself, and you know, the version you gave, which was much longer than just dog lovers. Once you limit yourself along those lines, the numbers just drop dramatically. So if in the book I go into an example where I looked up, I didn't go into the numbers on the dog site. But if I went on to the largest tennis site I could find, and I'm a big tennis, I play a lot of tennis. Mm-hmm. Well, I'd love for my partner to play tennis. But the numbers in terms of people who are so focused on tennis that they would go on to a tennis site, it's just not big enough. Mm-hmm. And so a thick market makes a lot of sense, meaning the most general market you can get to. There are these specialized sites, but they're only going to be successful when the critical mass in that particular specialty is big enough.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Michelle in Dallas. Hello, Michelle.
Hi there, Chris. I actually had a question kind of in regards to the numbers side of things. I'm a young professional in the Dallas area, and I kind of have noticed that I feel like the women on these dating sites, more often than the men, are looking for a more serious relationship often. And I feel like the men on these sites often, and these are generalizations, obviously, but are kind of looking for a broad range of things where, you know, if it were serious and if it worked out long term, they'd be maybe okay with that. But they'd also be okay with a lot of other things in between. So I kind of was curious about this, you know, playing into the odds and the factors for women versus men and, you know, how you kind of sort through the people who are actually looking for what you're looking for.
Thanks for your call.
So I think the evidence to mine, this is getting outside economics a little bit, but the evidence I've seen both anecdotally and in research and news reports is that Michelle is definitely right. I didn't catch her exact age, but I'm assuming she's in her 20s or
she
early
said young
30s.
Professional, so I'm guessing that's right.
And so, so now I'm going to give you the most analytical version of what can partially explain this. And this is, if you're a man that age, you have less incentive to get serious quickly. And, you know, that's just a biological fact. And the numbers, and the other thing is, it's not just about childbearing. It's also, although that's an important part of it, but it's also because of the numbers game. As people age, the number of eligible people begins to shift a lot more in favor of the men. So if you're a 30-year-old man, you know, you look ahead to being a 40-year-old man, the numbers will be more in your favor when you're 40, and so there's no real reason to get serious other than, you know, a lot of people want to get serious because they enjoy having a family. I certainly advocate that and everything. But, you know, for women, the numbers play out a little bit differently. There's a nice book by a woman named Lori Gottlieb, who I've gotten to know through the process of writing this book. And she talks about how that numbers game changes over time and some of the incentives that sort of differ for men and women in the way Michelle says.
We're speaking this hour with Paul Oyer about his new book, Everything I Ever Needed to Know About Economics I Learned from Online Dating. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. You can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Paul Oyer. He teaches economics at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, and he's the author of the new book, Everything I Ever Needed to Know About Economics I Learned from Online Dating. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Paul, what is adverse selection, and how does it play into online dating?
Well, luckily, it doesn't play into it as much as it used to. Adverse selection is the idea that is what is the term economists have given to a hidden information problem. A guy named George Akerlof at the University of California at Berkeley won the Nobel Prize for the original paper in this area. And his idea was in the used car market. So he said, suppose everybody out there who has a used car, some of them are what he called lemons and some are what he called plums. And the current owner knows which is which, but nobody else knows for sure. And so what happens is the price in that market will be such that only the people who own lemons will be willing to sell, because the buyers will know there's a good chance that the thing is a lemon and they'll drop the price down. And so what happens is all those who own plums just leave the market entirely. So in the used car market, you would have only clunkers get sold, and they get sold for a very cheap price. Well, the used car market was one application of this. This is exactly, by the way, and I talk about this a little bit in the book, this is exactly what's going on right now. The whole debate about the about the mandate in the Affordable Care Act is driven by adverse selection. So if the people, you've heard a lot about this, how if healthy people know that they're healthy, they have no incentive to buy insurance at the same prices as the sick people are buying them at. So we have to force them to do it in order for the system to work. And in the long term, the healthy people will someday become older and not as healthy, and it'll all work out and it'll be fair. The way this played out in the online dating market, at least initially, this also, by the way, another great example of adverse selection is the current job market, where if you've already been unemployed for 6 months, everybody assumes you're a terrible. You're damaged goods. So getting back to the online dating market, when online dating first came up, there was a adverse selection is the economist term for stigma. There was a stigma attached to it. If you went on online dating, the assumption was if you have to go onto a site to find a significant other, you must be a loser who can't do it through the regular way. And so as a result, people made assumptions. Anybody on an online dating site was a loser, and people who weren't losers would not try it. And over time, that broke down as the value of this marketplace became more apparent. But it was definitely one of the things that was hard for the market, for the online dating sites initially.
Positive assortative mating might sound like the wonkiest, worst dating service name ever, but it is, in fact, another economic term. Talk about that.
Well, we stole that one from the biologists. Mm-hmm. And positive assortative mating says that, you know, in the dating market, economists, we're known as the dismal science for a reason. And here's one, here's one great example. People love to think, oh, opposites attract, and I want to find a partner who's so different from me. And, you know, what was Pretty Women, the movie where Richard Gere falls in love with his call girl, who was mm-hmm. played by Julia Roberts. They love stories like that. Well, that's just not how the world works. Educated people marry other educated people. Rich people marry other rich people. If you look on dating sites, people end up being attracted to initially and especially staying and especially focusing in the longer term on people that are very much like themselves, at least in terms of class and in terms of race to some degree, but certainly in terms of class, education, other sort of identifiable characteristics. And, you know, in a way that may be sad, but it's just realistic. That's how the world works. We end up marrying people who are like ourselves. Now, there's been a lot of talk. The other night, President Obama was talking a lot about income inequality and particularly about income mobility. And positive assortative mating is in many ways problematic from that perspective, because if we did marry people who are very different from ourselves, that would help people move up and down the income distribution. But because rich people end up marrying other rich people, educated people marry other, high school dropouts marry each other instead of marrying up in the income distribution or the education distribution. And so unfortunately, these things become much harder to dig out of because of the way mating is done. It works out in the marketplace.
This is a total tangent and we'll only go here for a little while, but it's interesting because there was a time in history when men might be very well educated, but their wives often were not. And so I wonder if that shift accounts for some of the growth in income inequality that we've seen over the course of the 20th century.
I don't have an answer to that. That's a really good point. I have to think about that. That's a very good question. There is one, you know, the whole positive assortative mating thing has one side issue, which I can address quickly since I don't have a good answer to your question.
That's fine. I threw it at you out of left field, so it's totally fine.
No, but it's a good, I wonder if that does contribute a little bit. You might have a point there. There's a recent economics paper by a few economists, two of them are from the University of Chicago, and they find a very interesting thing along the lines of what you're talking about. And that is that while men and women who both have high earnings potential end up married and having relationships and so forth, there's a tipping point. And if the woman earns more than the man, that's a very negative predictor on the future of the relationship. Hmm. So men like women who look good, and they like women who make more money up to a point. As soon as the woman makes more money than they do, the future probability of divorce or the end of the relationship go up significantly.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Martha in Frisco. Hello, Martha.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for your show. You put on some really good ones, but this one is especially hits home to me because I am currently on a dating site. And I'm 5'11", almost 6 feet tall, and very specific that I want someone taller than me because I feel like a giant if I'm around someone shorter. Mm-hmm. And I get these guys that say they're 6'2", and they show up and they're 5'8". and they don't think I'm going to notice the difference between 5'8" and 6'2", or between 60 and 48.
Right.
And so I don't understand the philosophy of not being truthful, because you're either never going to meet someone in person, which kind of defeats the purpose, or they're going to be extremely disappointed. So I don't understand why. I mean, I'm completely honest on mine. And then another thing is I get a lot of these canned responses. Oh, I think you're fabulous. You might be the girl of my dreams. And it's obvious that it's something that they have sent out to lots of people. So
yeah.
I'm getting very frustrated. I don't understand why, if they're even on the site, why aren't they honest? And he was talking earlier about, you know, padding it a little bit. But it's so obvious that they were lying.
Well, Martha, I appreciate that. And forgive us for laughing, because I do empathize with your predicament completely, and I can see how frustrating that would be. Paul, you write in the book about some sites that have actually tried, they've experimented with verifying certain information points that people put in their online profiles, which, amount in some ways to resumes.
Yeah, the two sites that I know of that have done this are one's in South Korea and one's in China. And so, yeah, we could solve Martha's problem, at least on height, by just asking if every dating site just asked you to take the simple trouble of sending in a scanned copy of your driver's license. You know, you could fudge it, I guess, so you could cheat on that. But even if we could somehow get the data off your driver's license, because it would tell you, it would verify, I believe that, you know, in most states, that's going to have your height. It's going to have your age. And so we could verify little things simply like that. Now, why don't we see that done in the market? It would solve so many problems. It would, you know, solve a lot of frustration, especially for, keep in mind, in Martha's predicament is a little bit unusual, because she's absolutely right. She can tell the difference between what the guy says about his height and what it is given. But a lot of people don't notice that difference. I mean, 6'2 and 5'8, yeah, that's pushing your luck. You're not going to get a second date with anybody. But, you know, if you're 6 feet and you're, if you say you're 6 feet and you're really 5'10, that you might get away with. So Martha's, but how would we solve Martha's predicament? And why don't we see this happening? And it turns out this is a case where what seems efficient to the economists, that is to have these verification services, is maybe not what's in the best interest of the dating sites themselves. Keep in mind that if you're a dating site and you need to make money, you're trying to, obviously these guys are in business to make money. And their business model is all about scale. It's let's write a good software program and then everything is done. All of our costs are done. If they have to verify information, that's very costly. Then it suddenly changes the business from a fixed cost business to a marginal cost business where each one has to be verified. And so I think that's been one of the things that has held back dating sites, especially in the U.S. where labor costs are very high, from moving more towards verification. But I, you know, very sympathetic to Martha, because I certainly saw my view my share of exaggeration online, and I didn't have nearly as much at stake in terms of these subtler differences that people lie about as she does.
So, Paul, talk about this from an economic perspective. If, ironically, if any dating site does its job, its most satisfied customers are instantly gone from the site forever, right? You find someone, you make a match, you stay faithful to them, and you never go back to Match.com or Christian Mingle or whatever you've been using.
So that comes back to the idea of adverse selection, of course, right? Which in the following way, if the people on the website, the people who are on the website who've been there for years are maybe there for years because they're unattractive or they're lying or they're incapable of building a relationship, whereas the people who are good are going to pair off and leave very quickly. And so I think, and I don't, this you know, it's hard to get a dating site to to give you a lot of good information about this. But I think once you've been on a, the way the dating sites are dealing with this is if you've been on a site for too long or for a long time, or you have a pattern of not responding, you know, very low response rate, I think the dating sites know this, you know, they obviously have the information. I think it's in their best interest and probably is truly in everybody's best interest for them to not suggest you as often as they might otherwise. So to lower the probability that they're going to show you to someone else. Now, unfortunately, this leads to one of the many ways in which people can game a dating site, because you just shut down your profile and start again under a new name if that's going to be an issue. So if you've been on a dating site for a year and you're worried about either the dating site or the people on it somehow knowing that and thinking about adverse selection, you just, you know, switch from being Paul 813 to Paul 792 and start all over again.
How serious is the issue of discrimination, even among people who, for example, say they'd be open to dating someone of another race, but don't respond to letters from people who might contact them, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I haven't seen enough. I haven't seen that much data on that. I haven't seen a lot of details on exactly the interracial stuff. People definitely have preferences on average for people of their own race. And I think they respond less to people. I don't have enough professional experience or data to back this up, but I think the data suggests that people state much more a willingness to see people of the of a different race than they actually than you would guess based on their actual responses. And, you know, I wouldn't find that surprising. I mean, I think a lot of people think to themselves, I don't discriminate. But then when they see an actual message from somebody of a different race, you know, so, even if in the front of their mind they're not saying, oh, that person is such and such a race, you could easily imagine where that would color their views.
So have you had lovelorn grad students asking you for advice on how to find the person of their dreams?
You know, I would have to say that the creepiest thing you could imagine is asking your 50-year-old professor for love life advice.
That's almost worse than asking dad, right?
Exactly. So I don't offer that service, and I have to say that nobody has sought it out. I have recommended chapters from my book to go along with things I've been teaching in class. I don't require it because I think that's pushing things a little bit. So my students find the whole thing kind of interesting, but they don't come back to me and say, okay, now help me with my profile.
Paul Oyer is Fred H. Merrill, professor of economics at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. His new book is called Everything I Ever Needed to Know About Economics I Learned from Online Dating. He joined us today from the studios at Stanford University. Paul, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, the pleasure was all mine. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. We had help on the phones today from Katie Daniel. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and send email to the show via, at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.